So thank you so much to Asian American and Asian Research Institute and to Anthony for this tremendous opportunity to be able to talk about in such length about the field work that I'm currently doing. It's a really rare opportunity for a graduate student to be able to speak at such length about her research. So I really appreciate the opportunity and to all of you for being here. And so, yeah, I just wanted to start with a quotation from a person who I'm calling Stella. I'll be using pseudonyms throughout to protect the identity of the folks that I do my research with. And so Stella is an undocumented student who serves as a volunteer organizer with Korean Resource Center, a Southern California-based Korean-American immigrant rights organization that's one of the main organizations I'll be talking about this evening. And in a recent interview, Stella said the following regarding what she perceives to be the main goal of her and Korean Resource Center, or KRC's, activism. She said, "The end goal is not that we're fighting for citizenship, you know, because citizenship is a good thing to have, but it's not everything. Like, Black Americans have citizenship, but they're still getting killed by the police. So if our lives are still valueless regardless of a piece of paper or a green card, then it doesn't really mean anything. So I guess, like, the end goal is to achieve social equity or social justice. Yeah, when we can, like, you know, dismantle all these institutional barriers and build other bridges. I think that's, like, what we're trying to achieve. Not to become part of some society where people can value us because we look like them or because we, you know, act like they want us to act." So Stella's comments speak to a central question that informs my talk this evening. What forms does resistance take when it simultaneously involves demanding recognition from the state while denying the state's legitimacy as the ultimate arbiter of liberation that activists seek? Stella's words speak to a conviction that immigrants' rights work predicated solely on seeking legal recognition from the state will always be incomplete, and that other forms of resistance are necessary for seeking truly intersectional immigrant justice. So over 10 months so far of ethnographic research, I followed organizers in the National Korean American Services and Education Consortium, or NACASEC, a network of Korean American immigrant rights organizations across the U.S., as they gain notoriety as one of the most influential undocumented Asian American Pacific Islander or AAPI grassroots organizing institution within the national immigrant rights movement. I've sought to understand the contradictions that emerge for these organizers as they attempt to resist Asian exceptionalism narratives that aim to place them at odds with the Black and Latinx colleagues with whom they seek to build alliances. And I'll be using Latinx, the gender-neutral term, instead of Latino or Latina throughout. Specifically, I've asked how these organizers navigate a politics of immigrant deservingness that stem from continued conscription of certain Asian Americans in sustaining the illusion of U.S. racial liberalism and meritocratic neoliberalism that systematically aim to discount claims to unending racialized oppression. A tension common to many social justice movements emerges in NACASEC's work. A drive to demand rights and recognition from the state exists alongside the conviction that any such demands must be made within state-legible discourses and rationales that only allow for for narrowly circumscribed notions of justice. So, for example, a call for citizenship, no matter how inclusive, is always limited by the systemic racial oppressions from which citizenship has failed to offer relief for, say, Black and Native American communities. So here I have pictures of NACASEC organizers doing two different kinds of work. The first, taken in December 2017, shows activists engaging in a sit-in in Senator Chuck Schumer's office. Activists stage a series of protests at the Democratic leader's office in the final months of 2017, referring to this picture here, to push for what they called a Clean Dream Act. So just a refresher on the Dream Act, it's a form of legislation that has not been successfully passed, but that has been introduced in different forms since 2001. It would provide a path to legalization, in some cases citizenship, for undocumented youth who are fulfilling a certain set of educational professional requirements. Typically, in order to make the DREAM Act more palatable to more conservative lawmakers, it's been attached to provisions for enhanced border enforcement, more money for ICE, etc. So such a trade-off, activists argue, fragments immigrant communities and facilitating relief for those deemed innocent and worthy at the expense of criminalized others, which is why they're calling it a clean DREAM Act. So here, activists are demanding a form of recognition from the state, a path to legalization for those covered under the DREAM Act, even as they attempt to assert control over the terms of that recognition. And the second picture, taken, which I just took in August 2018, depicts a scene from a typical morning in the 36-day Journey to Justice bike tour that Nakasek activists organized from Seattle to San Diego, which they just finished up and which I just got back from spending a few days on. Here the activists are speaking with members of a Universalist church in rural California that provided food and housing for the bikers for the night, and they're talking to them about the mission of the bike tour. And that mission wasn't one that focused on issuing a specific set of demands, but rather one that sought to learn about and bridge the struggles of local immigrant communities in different cities and towns across the West Coast. The picture depicts one such moment in which activists in a small church in a small town in rural California build community with a group of people with whom they most likely would have never had contact. I'm going to be speaking in greater detail about the bike tour later on throughout the talk. But for now, I want to ask, what are these two kinds of activism doing? The latter comes from a recognition that a DREAM Act, no matter how clean or free of attached enhanced enforcement provisions, can't but sustain the notion that there's an innocent class of immigrants who, by virtue of certain contributions to society, are more deserving than their ostensibly criminal or less worthy counterparts. As such, Nakasek organizers, along with many others in the immigrant rights community, recognize that their activism can't rest its laurels on the extent to which the state is willing to cede politically to their demands for inclusivity. Deep community organizing does the work that policy can't. But this recognition hasn't meant that Nakasek organizers don't continue to demand citizenship for all or a clean DREAM Act. But it has meant creating other forms of resistance based on alternative modes of citizenship and radical inner and intra-community self-care that have nothing to do with state-sanctioned inclusion. So in this presentation, I want to suggest that in examining Nakasek solidarity work with other racialized immigrant communities, looking solely to the discursive and material practices of organizers as they engage in formal political processes is to miss where some of the most meaningful and innovative solidarity work is being done. And by formal political processes, I include both institutional civic engagement, so voter registration, calling and meeting with elected officials, gathering petitions, and also disruptive protest, marches, rallies, sit-ins, mass arrests, etc., that nonetheless center in the last instance on a demand to the state. And in assessing Nakasek's work beyond the scope of its explicitly political engagement, it becomes possible to appreciate the unique spaces of resistance that the network has created. Nakasek's brand of activism is one that focuses less on bringing large numbers of protesters out for explosive and highly visible yet short-lived rallies or marches, and more towards long-term sustained action that builds on years of grassroots organizing to bring together leaders into intense and intimate spaces for prolonged periods of time. And then as a corollary to the central point, I also want to suggest that these spaces have become opportunities for critically assessing the role of Korean and other Asian Americans in immigrant and racial justice work in ways that do the difficult work of addressing how these communities can at times both benefit and express complicity with anti-blackness and white racial hegemony. Susan Koshy has warned of, quote, the dangers of a racial politics that leaves untheorized the relationship between an intermediary racial group and other marginalized groups in the racial hierarchy, end quote. She's called on AAPI activists and scholars to, quote, develop conceptions of agency that account for complicity and resistance within intermediary groups. Nakasek's immigrant rights activism serves as a unique prism to explore one group's attempts to develop such complex conceptions of agency. So some brief background on NACASEC before moving on. Founded in 1984, NACASEC's mission is to organize Korean and Asian Americans to achieve social, racial, and economic justice. Its affiliates are comprised of Korean Resource Center in Southern California, HANA Center in Chicago, and NACASEC Virginia, which is located in Annandale, Virginia. The organization builds on the legacy of Young Koreans United, or YKU, which from 1983 to 2008 operated a series of community centers across the U.S. YKU was founded by Korean Americans who had migrated to the U.S. after being key players in South Korea's student and democratization movements in the 1960s and 1980s. The organization focused primarily on South Korean democratization, anti-U.S. imperialism, as you see in the photo, and peninsular reunification struggles. And the photo here is of an early YKU protest in Los Angeles. The 1992 Los Angeles uprising, however, somewhat problematically known in more popular terms as the Rodney King or L.A. riots, brought Korean Americans to the center of what has come to be known as one of the most tumultuous instances of urban interracial strife in American history. Alternating images of South Central and Koreatown-based Korean American store owners standing on the roofs of their stores, protecting their property with Uzis, and or lamenting the tremendous losses incurred during the events, played over and over again in the newly established 24-hour news cycles and sent shockwaves throughout Korean America. This prompted YKU to shift its attention towards racial justice struggles in the U.S. And I'll talk in greater detail about the centrality of the L.A. uprisings to NACASEC's trajectory a little bit later on. More recently, however, due largely to the 1997-98 Asian financial crisis, a 249% increase in undocumented migration from South Korea between 2000 and 2013 has made Korean Americans the second fastest growing undocumented Asian American community. These statistics are even more surprising when one considers that the growth rate of undocumented Asian Americans in general exceeds that of migrants of Mexican and Central American origin. So in recent years, NACASEC has invested much of its energy and resources in both local and national campaigns to advocate for Korean and other Asian Americans with precarious legal statuses. And while several AAPI organizations are doing indispensable work on the level of policy advocacy and local immigrant rights work, in terms of grassroots organizing and direct action, the growing strength and visibility of the NACASEC network within the nationally connected immigrant rights network world is simply unparalleled. And two dynamics, among several others, make the modes of resistance in which NACASEC's emergent leadership has chosen to engage particularly interesting. The first is the nature of the campaigns NACASEC has designed and implemented in the context of national immigrant rights advocacy. NACASEC certainly leads and participates in civic engagement campaigns, congressional meetings, sit-ins, rallies, marches, etc., but the majority of its time and resources are often dedicated to long-term actions whose symbolic power rests in the sheer perseverance of the activists involved. Two of these campaigns are particularly notable, and I'll be referring to them throughout the presentation. The first took place from August to September 2017, in which NACASEC protesters and affiliates camped out for 24 hours a day for 22 days in front of the White House. To protest the impending rescission of the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA, program. DACA, announced in 2012 as an Obama administration executive action, provides temporary reprieve from deportation for young undocumented immigrants who meet a series of strict requirements. The 22-day period of the vigil had been designed to start on August 15th in commemoration of the fifth anniversary of the implementation of DACA, and end September 5th when the Trump administration was poised to announce the program's termination. So I just want to show you some videos and pictures of that protest.
Thank you.
Well, what this video is showing is the opening kind of day of the protest. Is it working? Okay. Is the opening day of the protest where the Nakasek organizers are playing pungmul, which is a traditional form of Korean drumming that's been very central to South Korean protest culture. And other organizations from the D.C. area and beyond have come to support them. And there's a press conference and a rally, et cetera. The top right picture is just a typical scene, day of the vigil. Folks stood for in 8-hour shifts. They took 8-hour shifts, 24 hours a day, with these signs talking to passersby about the importance of DACA, informing them, you know, getting them to speak to their legislators. And then in the bottom, so what they would do every hour is a DACA dance. So they had basically a big loudspeaker, and they would have a dance party every hour. So folks passing by, tourists on the street would come and learn about DACA and dance all together. So it was a trying experience, but it was also a joyous one in some ways. So then the second one was a 36-day action in summer 2018, the bike tour that I was just talking about. So during that action, activists rode bicycles some 1,700 miles from the Canadian to Mexican border, so essentially from Seattle to San Diego. And they stopped in dozens of towns and cities along the way to hold healing sessions, press conferences, and direct actions with local immigrant rights groups to demand citizenship for all immigrants and communities of color who may have formal citizenship but are denied full access to the benefits the institution ostensibly affords. So the video is a meeting in Fresno, California, activists conducted with a local Laotian prayer group, and they're singing the Journey to Justice song that they had written as a way to express solidarity and gratitude to the communities that hosted them along the tour. And then this is just a picture from one of the several rest stops, water stops that they would take. So they were doing between 60 and 80 miles a day. So a support van would kind of follow them, go ahead of them, set up food and water every 20 miles. How they maintained that level of energy, I don't know. But so again, trying experience, but also a very joyous one. And both the 22-day vigil and the 36-day bike tour centered around a specific demand from the state. But as I want to show, the meaning that activists attach to their participation in this kind of work rests less on the faith that these demands will be satisfactorily met and more on resistance through radical community building that foments alternative forms of citizenship and belonging that really have nothing to do with state recognition. And then in the second part of the presentation, I want to talk about the second interesting dynamic at play in Nakasek's work, which is the organization's investment in building a movement that advocates for undocumented Asian Americans while not flattening the ways that racialization intersects with immigration status to produce diverse lived experiences and consequences for undocumented Black, Latinx, and Asian Americans, as well as for Asian Americans of different nationalities. So of particular interest is Nakasek's solidarity work with the UndocuBlock Network, which is an organization that advocates for undocumented Black immigrants, calling attention to the ways that mass incarceration, police brutality, and other manifestations of anti-Blackness intersect to create particularly harrowing lived experiences for the communities that they represent. Nakasek and UndocuBlock Network have come together in powerful ways to protest what they describe as the marginalization of Black and Asian Americans from immigrant rights discourse, and to dispel the notion that so-called Black-Korean conflict is based on some sort of primordial antagonism rather than a structural rights white supremacy that thrives on keeping oppressed people isolated from one another. Most importantly, Nakasekan and Docu Black Network's alliance has not only focused on outward-facing demonstrations of solidarity, whose main audience consists of politicians or the press, but also on intimate, closed-door convenings to foster difficult conversations about the imposed, but at times internally perpetuated fictions that Black and Korean people are each other's enemies. So just a little history lesson before continuing on. I just want to talk about the roots of this type of organizing that I'm talking about that characterizes Nakasek's contemporary work and kind of contextualize it within the organization's history. So YKU's primary founder was Yunan Bong, a democratization activist, who after being blacklisted by the South Korean government for his protagonism in the May 18 Gwangju People's Uprising. For those not familiar with that, May 18, 1980, there was a people's uprising in the South Korean city of Gwangju against the rise of military dictator Chun Doo-hwan, which was brutally repressed by U.S.-backed government forces, leading to the massacre of some estimated 600 civilians, and it's often referred to as a pivotal turning point in the country's democratization movement. So after his protagonism in that uprising, Mr. Yoon is blacklisted by the South Korean government and escapes South Korea in 1981 by traveling 40 days in the bottom of a cargo ship to seek asylum in the U.S. And after arriving to the U.S., Mr. Yoon founds YKU to mobilize the Korean diaspora to create an overseas solidarity movement for South Korean democratization. Members of the original YKU community, many of which sit on the board of directors of Nakasek affiliate organizations today, were, and to a certain degree, still are guided by Yoon's organizing philosophy. And that philosophy was rooted in the kind of radical organizing that characterized South Korean student protest at the time, that of sacrificing one's formal education, family, and safety to work alongside factory workers or to even risk brutal state-sponsored incarceration and torture. Activism wasn't something that one did for work, but an entire way of life. And Yoon believed that pure and genuine social activism is realized by the integration of pure political ideals with how we live our lives. So Yoon and his disciples were extremely deliberate about bringing their volunteers into community spaces that embody the democratic and progressive ideals for which they fought. These spaces included political consciousness classes and daily communal meals in which everyone from the oldest executive director to the youngest intern was responsible on a rotating basis to bring food to share for the whole team. So one person was responsible for making a main dish, another for making rice, another for bringing banchan, another for setting the table. And then also this notion that activism wasn't just something you did in addition to your normal life. Was also embodied in the belief that the organization's executive director should be paid the least. So Dave Shin, again, these are all pseudonyms, a former director of New York City's Mingguan Center for Community Action, which until 2008 formed part of the Nakasek network, reflected on these practices. He said, quote, "There's some really important principles that thrive on today that come out of the sort of Yunnan Bong school of thinking. You know, and I think they're important to understand that there's an emphasis on, like, political education, conscious raising, you know, discussion and conversation about what it means to sacrifice for the cause, being part of a movement. It's not just like, hey, call this elected official and let's plan for this march. It's also about what are we doing and why are we doing it? You see yourself as a part of this longer vision and tradition. Because if that goes away, it's just like, I'm working in a tight space for long hours and making a crappy salary." End quote. Those of us who have worked in nonprofit spaces know that. So Shin speaks to a culture of activism founded on the notion that a social movement is only sustainable and complete when the more just world activists seek to bring into being are forged from the inside out. Of course, activism in the context of the South Korean democratization movements in the 1980s looks very different from the activist work of 21st century U.S. nonprofits. As several YKU activists told me, the organization in its earliest days was entirely volunteer-run. Volunteers would raise money for the organization's humble operating costs by selling flowers on the side of the highway or collecting bottles and cans from nightclubs on the weekend. But the professionalization of organizing now means that organizations like NACASEC don't have to rely, as its predecessors did, on the sacrifice of volunteers. Rather, through grassroots, governmental, and private foundation funding, it can build a staff of at least modestly compensated employees with more or less formal worker rights and benefits. But as some scholars and activists charge, the formation of the nonprofit industrial complex has created an environment in which once radical social movements are incorporated into and become reliant upon government agencies and private foundations that materially and ideologically restrict the scope of activist work. Critics of contemporary nonprofit space also allege that the corporatization of nonprofit structures is inconsistent with the communal and democratic ideals they preach. So under such conditions, the notions that the executive director should be paid less than their employees becomes entirely untenable. So the challenge for NACASEC has been adapting the organizing philosophy inherited from its predecessors to work within the context of a contemporary U.S. 501c3 nonprofit. In the following sections, I explore how NACASEC organizers have attempted to bring to bear on the present the activism as life traditions upon which their movement was founded. I suggest this tradition continues on in modified forms through efforts to create alternative modes of activist community citizenship. So over the past year, legislative and judicial ping-pong on the fate of the DACA program, plus frustrated attempts to convince even those Democrats who pride themselves on fighting for the Dreamers to make concrete commitments to pushing a Clean Dream Act, has left little cause for celebration in the way of legislative victories. Thousands of activists flooded congressional offices daily throughout the end of 2017 to push representatives to come up with a permanent legislative solution for DACA protected immigrants before the program was to be terminated in March 2018. Repeated, disappointing, and maddening encounters with politicians throughout this time fostered among some young activists an increasing disillusionment with institutional political engagement. Young Jin, a NACASEC organizer, grew frustrated in late November 2017 when in a meeting with 35 undocumented Asian Americans, members of the Congressional Asian Pacific American Caucus, or KPAC, tiptoed their way around making a public statement that they would refuse to vote on an end-of-year spending bill unless it included provisions for a Clean Dream Act. The hypocrisy grew too much for Young Jin when, after failing to make such a concrete commitment, KPAC requested a photo opportunity with the group of young immigrants. Young Jin abruptly walked out of the meeting, slamming the door behind him while chanting, "No Dream Act, no government." This growing disillusionment with institutional politics has brought NACASEC activists to articulate alternative forms of resistance and to attach meaning to their work that extends beyond achieving legislative goals. For many interlocutors, the social microcosms created in the context of actions like the 22-day vigil or the 36-day bike ride can be understood as acts of resistance in their own right. The deep sense of community self-care fostered by those trying experiences was not positive collateral to a more overtly political goal, but rather the goal itself. So that night that Young Jin walked out of the KPAC meeting, we sat facing each other on two fold-out mattresses in a dimly lit church basement in Southeast D.C. The church had offered its basement as a place for some 80 NACASEC affiliated activists to stay throughout the course of the action. And some of the college-age protesters who had to catch a red eye back to California the following day because they were in the middle of finals huddled together as they studied for their exams. Others, some of the high school activists, sat with their heads peeking out of their sleeping bags and were propped up on their elbows and sharing snacks. Some of the older Korean-American women who formed part of the undocumented parent group sat around doing each other's hair, giving each other massages, and talking very excitedly. And their loud laughing peppers the recording of my conversation with Young Jin. We were reflecting on the last time we were in D.C. for the 22-day vigil. During those 22 days, as I mentioned, participants would take turns doing 8-hour shifts, standing with signs, dancing, and playing pungmul on the shadeless street in front of the White House under the blistering August D.C. sun. The core constituency of protesters constituted Nakasek-affiliated activists from high school teens to grandmas in their 70s. But as the days went on, local D.C. residents and tourists joined. There were also some people who, motivated by the protesters' resilience after seeing their videos on Facebook live feed, flew themselves across the country to join the action. Youngjin grinned as he told me by day 17 of the action that a man experiencing homelessness who had previously objected to Nakasek setting up the protest base camp in the park where he slept came up to Youngjin, took money out of his shoe, and put it in the donation bin. The man said, "I don't know what the fuck you all are doing here, but it's important, and I moved." So recalling this moment brought Youngjin to a wonder aloud to me. Quote, "What is the point of a protest? Is it only successful if a bunch of press shows up or some politician gives us what we want? If there's no press, should we just all go home?" End quote. He went on to express frustration at what he perceived to be a tendency within much mainstream immigrant rights organizing to bring thousands of people to a big rally for a few hours and then all go home. Such kinds of protests, while indispensable to bringing public attention to the cause, is not for Youngjin where the real resistance work is done. That work was done here, in a church basement at 1 in the morning, with undocumented people and their loved ones learning to survive together. He wondered when the time came if undocumented solidarity was just based on a few rallies rather than deep and meaningful relationships. Would dreamers be willing to throw everybody else under the bus? Would undocumented APIs play along with ideas about immigrant criminality that doubly burden their undocumented Black and Latinx colleagues? Pointing around the room, Youngjin said, quote, "This is how we build a movement that makes sure no one is left behind, not just waiting and seeing how politicians are going to play with our lives," end quote. And Youngjin's comments speak to a frustration expressed by social movement scholars regarding overly rigid perceptions about what constitutes an act of political resistance. Looking at protest as what Susan Coutine calls an exception to the normal state of affairs is to miss the everyday processes that constitute how activists come to articulate alternative historical meanings and visions of the future, and what the process of participating in the movement means for participants themselves. Haven and Kasnabish add that the true life of social movements are found not in spectacular moments of victory and defeat, but rather in the banal ways that movements reproduce themselves every day. They write that, quote, "The true life of the radical imagination, like the life of each of us, isn't made up of moments of success and triumph. It's made up of the everyday work of reproducing life, moments when social movements actually succeed and rupture or transform the flows of social reproduction are no doubt important, but equally important is the routine, mundane, and often heart-wearying labor of reproducing the radical imagination in what we call the hiatus, the long winter of dwelling between success and failure," end quote. Processes of subversion occur, as Coutine states, quote, "not only through strategic actions, but also through the informal, non-political, yet nonetheless insurrectional practices participants develop alongside prototypical movement practices. These are the moments in which activists don't just perform radicalness and political discourse in front of cameras or lawmakers. There are moments in which activists articulate ways to live radically, to develop ways of consuming, loving, working, and otherwise being in this world in ways that are consistent with the new worlds they seek to bring into being. One such form of radical imagining arose when Persert, an undocumented Thai American volunteer organizer with Korean Resource Center, suggested that he and others involved in an undocumented AAPI youth support group he was organizing engage in what he called an undocumented gift economy. Persert explained that undocumented people are excluded from mainstream resources, and quote, "The way people become undocumented in the first place has a lot to do with capitalism. So why," he wondered aloud, "should we as undocumented folk participate in the very systems that screw us over?" He and his friends had thus started to informally, in Persert's words, use the natural talents we have to care for each other in ways that stand outside capitalist modes of production, of consumption. Persert is good at cutting hair, but he's terrible at cooking, so he cuts his friend's hair. The friend getting the haircut makes extra food that he gives to Prasert, which ultimately saves Prasert the money he would have spent at a fast food conglomerate. Prasert said, why can't we do this on a larger scale and bring undocumented people to support one another? He said he was moved to start a program like this after learning in his ethnic studies courses about the Black Panther Free Breakfast and other Serve the People programs. The conversation that ensued between the activists circled around what some might find tedious logistics. When would Prasert be available to cut hair? If they were doing food exchanges, what about people who had dietary restrictions? Should they be using Google Docs or Slack to keep track and ensure equity in exchanges? And how would they define an equal exchange? So what I've tried to illustrate here is how resistance is found not only in the negotiations that activists undertake as they discuss optimal material and discursive strategies to issue demands to the state, but also in the ways that they develop new forms of sociality that refuse participation in the ideological systems that oppress them. The processes of imagining, creating, and enacting are not legible in the numbers of people who show up to a protest, the number of media outlets that came to cover the event, or even in a distance reading of the language they deploy to articulate demands. So until now, I've tried to show that while Nakasek organizers engage in modes of protest outwardly oriented towards legislative goals, the significance they assign to such action lies in resistance forged the creation of communities of radical undocumented self-care. In this second section, I want to explore this dynamic specifically in the dimension of Nakasek's work focused on building solidarity with UndocuBlack Network. With this work, both organizations are asking what it means to seek representation for both Asian American and Black immigrants within an issue and movement overwhelmingly racialized as Latinx. But both organizations have been careful not to flatten the ways that racialization creates different consequences and lived experiences for undocumented Black and Asian Americans. How to account for the fact that in 2016, undocumented Black and Latinx immigrants are 6.7 times as likely as undocumented Asian Americans to become incarcerated, or that undocumented Black immigrants represent almost the same proportion of the incarcerated undocumented population as Latinxes, despite the fact that Black immigrants only comprise 575,000 of the estimated 11.2 million undocumented people living in the U.S. Within the context of immigrant rights activism, how to reckon with the past and present of policing and criminalization of Black resistance. Seeking representation for undocumented Asian Americans while also taking these manifestations of anti-Blackness seriously means having to develop strategies that go beyond just saying, we're oppressed too. Meaningful solidarity means having to not only resist the continued deployment of modeled minority discourse to delegitimize Black resistance, but also having painful conversations about the perpetuation of anti-Blackness within AAPI spaces. As such, Nakasek and UndocuBlack Spunning Alliance form what I want to call a contentious solidarity, one whose sustenance requires constant renegotiation, rearticulation, self-criticism, and uncomfortable dialogue. Central to both Asian American studies and much AAPI activism has been the project of exposing how Asian immigrant exceptionalism narratives serve to mask pervasive racialized oppressions as the U.S. continues to project a facade of racial liberalism and meritocracy. By racial liberalism and meritocracy, I mean the ideological tools that sustain the notion that the U.S. is a land of opportunity for all, and that one's failure to succeed has nothing to do with structural disadvantage, but rather one's inherent flaws. The myth of the universally thriving Asian immigrant has and continues to be mobilized time and time again in the service of these narratives to not only prop up certain Asian Americans as the more desirable minority immigrant foil to their Black and Latinx counterparts, but also as a means to delegitimize the latter's claims to continued racialized oppression. An emergent literature within Asian American studies has also argued, however, that there's a need to examine model minoritization not just as an externally imposed discourse of post-racial, racialized discipline and management, but one that's often internally perpetuated. Erin Nin urges AAPI activists and scholars to stop projecting the locus of power and oppression outwards, and refrain from portraying ethnic communities and social institutions as impossibly innocent of accountability. So the recent mobilizations to defend, Asian American mobilizations to defend New York City Chinese American police officer Peter Liang's murder of unarmed black man Akai Gurley speak to the ongoing imperative to look inwards as well as outwards in theorizing AAPI complicity. As Kathy Schlein-Viles notes, Liang's advocates argued Liang was equally innocent as Gurley, even though Liang fatally fired his gun as Gurley, who was a mere passerby in a routine nightly surveillance of the housing project in which he lived, ran away from his assailants. According to this narrative, the true culprit was a white supremacist system that attempted to pit the death of a young black man against an equally innocent Asian one. Such narratives, which rely on non-whiteness as the sole binding agent for solidarity, constitute what Schlein-Viles aptly calls a complicit solidarity. A complicit solidarity is one that fails to account not only for the ways that white supremacy and anti-blackness function to oppress racialized communities in different ways, but also for the ways that such oppressions can be internally perpetuated. The harrowing legacies of the 1992 LA uprisings and other instances of so-called Black Korean conflict make the imperative to move beyond complicit solidarities particularly urgent at the site of Nakasek and Ondaki Black Network's work. I follow a convention of using scare quotes around Black Korean conflict or use other terms, so-called, framed as, to contest the notion that Black and Korean Americans are actually the central protagonists in the fraught and occasionally violent encounters that occur and occurred between them. Scholars and activists argue that the popular framing of these conflicts as manifestations of Black rage and as a series of interpersonal bouts and cultural misunderstandings elides the centrality of white supremacy in producing the conditions that bring these communities into tension with one another in the first place. The cartoon depicted here kind of portrays that critique. So you have a Uncle Sam kind of figure and a media kind of figure pointing arrows at which is what supposedly a Black and Korean American figures, who are then pointing their fingers at one another instead of like the true culprits. Writing in the immediate aftermath of the LA uprising, Elaine Kim accused, quote, the news media of using Korean Americans and tensions between African and Korean Americans to divert attention from the roots of racial violence in the U.S. So Kim articulated a framework that has guided many Black Korean solidarity efforts since 1992, that of resisting, defying, and conquer tactics to demonstrate Black and Korean unity against white racial hegemony. More recently, however, scholars like Claire Jean Kim and Jared Sexton have asked difficult questions about to what extent laying these conflicts entirely at the feet of white supremacy wrongfully obscures anti-blackness in Korean America. Was it white supremacy ventriloquizing Soon Ja Do to shoot Latasha Harlins in the back of the head as a 15-year-old girl was leaving the store? So Soon Ja Do, this is in 1990 or 1991, was a Korean American store owner who got into a spat with this young woman, Latasha Harlins, 15 years old, over a supposedly stolen bottle of orange juice after Latasha slammed the orange juice back on the counter. She was leaving the store, and Soon Ja Do shot her in the back of the head. Subsequently, Soon Ja Do was only received a suspended prison sentence, was never sent to jail, and just received 5 years probation. So that's seen as one of the kind of predecessors to the LA uprising. So is it only white supremacy that's motivating Soon Ja Do to shoot Latasha Harlins? Or is it anti-blackness when enacted by non-whites, a racism that is more agentic than purely structural explanations give it credit for? Sexton charges that the white supremacy framing of Black-Korean conflict results in, quote, an inability or refusable to identify race and or class power on the side of Korean Americans. These calls for accounting for the ways that Asian American activist spaces can be sites of both resistance and complicity lay out a complex yet productive set of dynamics for Nakasek and Ondaki Black Network's work. The two organizations have indeed conducted joint press conferences, congressional visits, and rallies that have served as powerful symbols of Black Korean unity amidst efforts to structure antagonism between those two communities. Yet much of the meaningful solidarity work has taken place behind closed doors. Nakasek has attempted to answer Nin's call of not just projecting the locus of power and oppression outwards, by creating internal forums designed to foster difficult dialogue with Black colleagues and other Korean Americans about anti-Blackness in Korean communities and how racialization intersects with undocumented status to create diverse lived experiences and consequences. So in July 2018, Nakasek and UndocuBlack Network each sent 40 staff and volunteers to meet in Los Angeles for a two-day closed-door convening, which they called Uri Ujima. Uri, the Korean word for our, and Ujima from the Swahili word collective work and responsibility. So our collective work and responsibility. A few months earlier, in December 2017, the two organizations had come together for the first UndocuBlack AAPI Day of Action, with the goal of showing a collective display of solidarity to save the temporary protected status program and promote the passage of a Clean Dream Act. The primary feedback from participants from both organizations was that the Day of Action was so focused on press conferences and congressional visits that activists from each organization didn't have time for meaningful conversation and reflection with one another. They wanted to have more time to spend with one another and to speak deeply about the issues that affected their respective communities and their relationships with one another. Given this feedback, the two organizations decided to create a space that would allow the two groups to begin to take steps towards building understanding and creating genuine relationships, the kinds of relationships that must be fostered through nuanced and sustained conversation and a willingness to be made uncomfortable by those conversations. Sarah, one of the primary Nakasek organizers of the convening, said of the rationale behind hosting a closed-door event, quote, "Of course showing up for each other's actions and sending press releases and bumping social media content on each other's behalf is good. But if we don't build relationships, then the actual solidarity that we can build is always going to be kind of weak. We need to really feel something deeply if something happens to them and vice versa." So organizers were deliberate about approaching the event in a way that recognized that AAPIs can simultaneously be oppressed by white supremacy while partially benefiting from and actively uplifting the systems that sustain anti-Blackness. Approaching the event in this way meant having to engage in difficult conversations about the history and present of relationships between Black, Korean, and other AAPI communities. So the most trying dialogues, of course, took place around the workshop that centered on the legacy of the 1992 LA uprising. Some Nakasek leaders shared their experiences as store owners in the years leading up to and during the uprising. One woman shared that she became fearful of her Black customers after being held at gunpoint by a Black man who robbed her store. UndocuBlack leaders who lived in South Central at the time shared their experiences of racism from Korean store owners in their communities and the structural injustices that brought them to rise up. But the conversation that ensued wasn't one that repeated the dominant narrative that it's solely white supremacy structuring antagonism between Black and Korean people. Rather, bringing these stories together, said Sarah, allowed them to really talk deeply about how, quote, yes, there's this larger system that tries to pit Black and Korean people against one another. But we as AAPIs need to recognize how we both benefit from it and build on it. So we can understand why Koreans opened up stores in Black neighborhoods because they couldn't afford anywhere else. But we need to struggle with what it means to make resources off a community and then not be a part of building that community. We need to ask what's happening when we see Koreans on the roofs of their stores arming themselves and shooting at Black people when that's what the police do to Black people every day. Like, store owners may have lost their lives, but livelihoods, but Black people are losing their actual lives. End quote. So it's extremely difficult and heart-wrenching work to honor the emotional and financial losses incurred to the Korean-American community in the context of the LA uprising, while also attempting to have bigger picture conversations about how Korean-Americans can also benefit from the anti-Black structures that drove the uprising. So it's perhaps unsurprising then that some participants had really strong reactions to the discussion. Judy, a young Korean Resource Center organizer, said that she was shocked to hear some of the anti-Black comments made by some of the older generation Nakasek participants. For example, when UndocuBlack members were giving a presentation on how police brutality doubly affects undocumented Black immigrants, Judy heard one person mutter in Korean, "Well, if they just listened to the police, these things wouldn't happen." Judy described the episode as disheartening, stating that she felt like, quote, There's a lot of work to do in fighting for all undocumented immigrant rights, which includes fighting the racism within the undocumented community. We're an organization fighting for equality among all people. And seeing all those things, we realize we need to do training and examine anti-blackness even within our own organization. So the relationship NACASEC and Undocumented Black Network are building as they attempt to envision and implement an immigrant justice movement that doesn't just take undocumented status or non-whiteness as an unexamined source of unity is very much a work in progress. NACASEC has realized that taking anti-blackness seriously within immigrant rights organizing requires not only having difficult conversations with black-serving immigrant groups, but also within the ranks of its own organization. Should this work continue, organizers will spend years asking themselves what material and ideological principles constitute solidarity work that centers anti-blackness. What resources and alliances must we give up? What new ones must we form? And how do we develop material and discursive strategies that don't just refuse complicity with foundational anti-blackness, but rather actively seeks to deconstruct it? What I'm attempting to capture here, however, is the early stages of a project based on the conviction that solidarity must first depart from genuine relationships and profound compassion. NACASEC and Undocu-Black Network continue to support each other's legislative goals and join together to make public demands to the state, but neither organization departs from the belief that such actions constitute sufficient foundations for sustained and meaningful solidarity. The spaces they're creating are in and of themselves forms of resistance based on what Audra Simpson has called intercommunity recognition, care, and affection that deny the state the power to dictate how differently racialized immigrant and minority communities interact with one another. So, radical activists are doubly bound by the imperative to survive within and make demands legible within prevailing paradigms and material structures on the one hand, and to work towards subverting those structures on the other. Is it possible to use the law to dismantle the racialized, liberal, neoliberal, imperialist, class, gendered logics on which the law is based? Is engaging with institutional electoral politics a necessary stepping stone to imploding political systems that rely on suppressing some voices in order to uplift others? Is it possible to depend on financial resources provided by capitalist structures while also seeking to dismantle them? Imagining freedom beyond what hegemonic forces delimit as politically imaginable presents radical activists with the dilemma of, as Audra Simpson has said, to stop a story that's always being told. It's a difficult task of acting and imagining in ways that lie outside the dominant ideological forces that structure but don't determine what we imagine to be politically possible. Radical activists thus exist in a constant state of tension in which they must reproduce themselves within the very modes of social reproduction they seek to change. In the 2017-2018 year that lapsed between the 22-day White House vigil and the Uri Ujima convening and Journey to Justice bike tour, NACASEC decided as an organization to abandon its Clean Dream Act platform in favor of one that called for citizenship for all. This call for citizenship for all would include all 11 million undocumented people in the U.S., 35,000 inter-country adoptees without citizenship, as well as asylum and refugee seekers. Their call for citizenship includes not only those who are formally excluded from it, but those who may possess legal citizenship papers, but by virtue of their systemic marginalization are precluded from enjoying the full benefits the institution affords. But when I speak to organizers about the decision to make this shift, they're frank in saying that they don't actually believe that legislators will at any time in the near future be working on a bill that would provide a path to citizenship for all, or even a fraction of the groups listed above. Neither do they believe that formal citizenship is the answer to the structural racial injustice they seek to dismantle. NACASEC organizers and their allies charge forth based on the notion that an immigrant rights movement that seeks meaningful solidarity across differently racialized immigrants, or those deemed innocent and criminal, hardworking, or undeserving, can't be bound in the last instance to the extent to which the state is willing to cede politically to their demands for inclusivity. This conviction, however, hasn't translated into a refusal to participate in the formal political sphere. Organizers continue to issue demands to the state and to protest for and against certain legislative proposals, They engage in voter registration campaigns, go to congressional meetings, urge people to call their representatives, etc. So Nakasek organizers operate in the range of what Kim Fortune has called the middle voice. The middle voice describes the way activists navigate the opposing logics of imagining within and without of the immediate, of finding temporary repose in dominant ways of knowing and being while never fully finding rest in them. The middle voice for Fortune is, quote, a way of speaking that builds an awareness that the system that one critiques also operates within the critique. It's one that cannot but use the languages of law, bureaucracy, and categorization, insufficient as they are, to represent the completeness and messiness of life. But it also knows how implicated these languages are in the very hegemonies activists fight against. Activism, thus, requires, quote, demand for words that uphold entrenched regimes of power, alongside demand for words that disassemble, highlighted in every move to secure justice within the law, which works by discounting what cannot be translated into constitutional equivalencies, end quote. Some may charge that to operate in the middle voice is to engage in a certain degree of hypocrisy. How can you continue to engage with and issue demands to the very institutions you understand to be the root of the injustices you seek to dismantle? A colleague once asked me how I could reconcile the claim that these organizers are trying to build radical solidarity with black counterparts with the fact that they continue to engage with a state that's fundamentally anti-black. I found myself stuck on this point for a really long time. Is what I'm reading as the organizers struggle to find a middle voice through which to express simultaneous needs for both immediate survival and long-term liberation actually just a cop-out, or an easy way of paying lip service to solidarity while pursuing accommodationist goals? A quote from one of my mentors, Susan Coutine, helps me think through this dilemma. She says, rather than attempting to envision a purely counter-hegemonic act and then measuring actual incidents against that ideal, the task confronting analysts is to delve deeper into the multifaceted and often conflicting implications of actions. Such an endeavor would both expose the systems of power in which people operate and reveal the ways that people do, sometimes against tremendous odds, seek to create a more just society. Acknowledging that mediated as they are by the context in which they occur, such efforts will necessarily be imperfect, doesn't imply that they're not worthwhile, end quote. So what I've attempted to do this evening is explore ethnographically what it looks like every day on the ground as organizers engage in a process of trying to build a radically inclusive immigrant rights movement that doesn't take as its ultimate goal concessionary measures from the state. What I've not intended to do is suggest that Nakasek perfectly embodies the way forward in doing such difficult work. To engage in such a project would be to depart from the false premise that universally pure radical stances exist. But to ignore the work because it's imperfect is to suggest that anything short of revolution is simply not worth the ethnographer's time. Justice is not a stagnant end goal, but a process of constant negotiation and rearticulation. Thank you.
I think in order the cultures to mend, the importance of education and family life, that's something that should be worked on. We had a neighbor who was, and one of the things he said is that the black community needs to stay together. You know, the father can't leave the house all the time. So my point is, in trying to help this situation, where the, I think getting the families together and the, and talking about education process might help the situation. So the two communities can work together. I don't know if that's a question.
Yeah. So I think that some of what the way that that story has been framed is one that's bound up in two different things, which is narratives that pathologize black life. There's like a famous report from the 1960s called the Moynihan Report that said, the reason that that Black families are find themselves in such poverty is because the dad leaves home, and it's a matriarchal structure, and women can't run a household. And so it kind of stems back to that, which ironically is at the same time that the term we hear as model minority comes about, right? One reinforces the other. That, okay, like, look how great all these Asians are doing, and look how poorly all the Black people are doing. So it's not that the U.S. isn't providing structural advantages. It's this personal responsibility kind of narrative, which is what we call, like, you know, neoliberalism on a personal scale. It's also the other narrative that you know, the idea that, you know, Black folks don't have a right to resist the Korean stores because they didn't take advantage of the opportunities, supposedly, also comes from a much longer history of delegitimizing Black resistance. So you heard me referring to the what's usually called, like, the Rodney King riots as the LA uprising, right? So why do we call it an uprising instead of a riot? It's because the term riot has often been used to delegitimize the very explicit political and organizing structure that motivated these acts of political resistance. And calling it a riot makes it sound like it was like this irrational, spontaneous burst of rage that came out of nowhere, right? So I think we just have to be careful when we say we use these personal responsibility narratives, that it's the Black family or somehow a lack of education that is on their shoulders, right? And think about, A, the stories that are being told that are most cases not true, and B, the structural, that's why I keep saying anti-Blackness, not just, you know, hear people say white supremacy, but, like, the U.S. is a country that's founded, and I'm not just talking about material slave labor, but ideologically on the repression of Black people. So, yeah. That's a short answer to a very big question. Yes?
So I had a question on, I guess, sort of like regionality. So mm-hmm. I imagine you interacted with groups on both East Coast and West mm-hmm. Coast, and one thing that I've observed, I guess, living on both coasts and, I guess, Midwest for a while, is that, you know, like, there's a very different, I guess, culture and personality even within the mm-hmm. Asian American community.
Yeah.
For example, I would say that on the West Coast, there's much more, there's a higher percentage of the population that is second generation, third
yes.
generation, fourth generation, especially,
mm-hmm.
You know, Chinese Americans, like, who came over, you know, during the Gold Rush.
Right.
And they are, I guess for lack of a better word, like, more assimilated to American culture than mm-hmm. I think a lot of the Asian American communities on the East Coast.
Yeah.
So I was curious your thoughts on if that translates to the type of activism that you've seen,
totally.
their mentalities and
totally, yeah. So I've been in New York for the past 4 months doing research with Ming Guan Center, which is a Korean American serving immigrant rights organization, here in New York, which broke from the NACASEC network in 2008, but it was part of this original YKU family. But you're right, I was expecting to come from California. I'm from New York, but I still, like, because I had been doing my research out there, was expecting to come to New York and see, like, a very similar set of dynamics, especially because the two organizations had until recently been so intimately linked. But the challenges that Ming Guan folks are facing are very different from the challenges that, you know, and the leadership, too, is very different. So, you know, a lot of, right now at least, Ming Guan's central organizing is around seniors, right? Because you have, like, an aging senior population that is being pushed out by high rents out of Flushing, right? And then you also have more recent immigrants who are just, it's not a question of, it's like when you have, like, more immediate, not that undocumented folks on the West Coast aren't suffering and have extreme, you know, struggles, but people don't know where the resources are, right? They don't know that Mingguan exists. They don't know how to navigate the sources that are available to them. So it creates this very different dynamic around organizing, which is probably why you don't hear about Mingguan yet doing these kinds of larger campaigns, because they're much more focused on hyper-local work, which is not better or worse in any way. It's just very, very different. Yeah. Does that answer your question?
I mean, how does that compare to the West Coast?
So the West Coast, I mean, I just feel like you have a much more established network. Like even more recent immigrants, they're coming in with families, and folks often know how to through like either families or friends or whatever. And there's often more awareness of how to navigate social services or different opportunities that are available to folks. And because it's mostly second gen led organization, even though I must say Korean Resource Center, the Halmoni group, the grandma group, is like, they are so fierce. they defy like every stereotype that like, they were some of the ones that were standing out there in the, you know, but it's a different culture within the organizing. So you go to a Korean Resource Center meeting and, you know, people introduce themselves, and everyone knows exactly that they have to indicate what their pronoun is, right? So my name is Liz, my pronouns are she, her, hers, right? Because the leadership on the East Coast is more first generation, and there are a lot of second generation folks, something like that dynamic is still one that's being, it's like one that's more in transition right now, I guess, which can create sometimes, I don't want to say conflict, but sometimes, yeah, I guess conflict between different folks in the organization. So there's stuff that's like affecting internally within the organization, but then also the communities that they serve. Nadia.
Thanks for your talk.
Thank you.
I really loved how you started out talking about the tension between wanting state legitimacy through citizenship, but then not wanting to work within those parameters. And it made me think of Monisha Dasgupta's work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I would love to hear if or how these activists can be put in conversation with the South Asian activists of Boston and New York,
right,
who basically said, we don't give a shit about citizenship.
Mm-hmm.
We have a transnational complex of rights as humans and workers that we decouple from citizenship, right?
But yeah.
It sounds like they're more, like we're trying to navigate in and out of it.
Right.
So I have a two-part question. I'm trying to make as brief as possible. Like one of the main motivations of my work, as you know, is mm-hmm. also to deal with the fact that there is also another hierarchy related that places Black's Americanness,
right,
more authentic Americanness, above Asian Americans, and that Asian Americans are racialized as foreigners vis-a-vis
right.
Blacks being seen as more American.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's lots of different examples of that, whether it's Black soldiers in Vietnam or whatever. Like, you can
right.
just go on and on, right? Jeremy Lin, right? You know, one of the things I'm wondering is, why are we not talking about that as much? Or why are we not talking about the two together, right? Because in my view, white supremacy depends on both. White
mm-hmm.
supremacy depends on actually erasing the racial foreignness and the racist nativism or white nationalism
right.
against AAPI.
Mm-hmm.
If we don't talk about those together, are we fully addressing white supremacy? And are we actually fully investing Black Americans of their full agency, too?
Right, yeah.
Because racism, institutionalized racism, depends on all of us internalizing all of this.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And none of us are immune from it.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Can you remind me of the
one was, in Monisha Dasgupta's work, she says that the
right.
immigrant activists don't want mm-hmm. citizenship at all.
Right.
It's just not in their political
calculus. Right, right. Yeah. So, yeah, I'm very influenced by Monisha Dasgupta's
yeah.
work. And I was reading her book, Unruly Immigrants, at the same time I was reading Audra Simpson's book, which is Mohawk Interruptus, where she develops this notion of refusal. And so she's talking, Audra Simpson is talking about this Mohawk nation, I forget which nation specifically, who basically also refuse citizenship. Like, they have citizenship in the United States, but they say, if I accept citizenship from you, then I accept that my own domination was legitimate.
Right.
And so, and Monisha is saying something similar, right? And I want to be able to think about Nakasek activists in that network, in that sense. But it's not quite there consistently all the time. Yeah. And I, you know, it's not like, and you said, you know, and like Monisha Dasgupta, she says, okay, we're going to draw on this transnational complex of human rights. And something that sometimes I think frustrates some activists within the immigrant rights world on one hand, Korean American immigrant rights world, and then folks who are organizations like Subak on the West Coast or Not Do Dol and here in New York, is that there's no conversation, there is maybe, but it's like not this deep conversation about what drives people to be undocumented in the first place, are histories of, you know, or what drove, you know, so many undocumented South Koreans to come here. Well, okay, well, you know, IMF crisis, hit decades of U.S. imperialism in South Korea. And why aren't we having this like conversation about, we need to be calling on this, like, why am I subjecting myself to this, that my worth is dependent on whether or not the U.S. is going to grant me citizenship, when U.S. imperialism is the reason that I'm here in the first place, right? But that conversation isn't happening amongst most people. So I'm trying to think about, like, is it still Audra Simpson's notion of refusal if people are doing both? I'm just going to get to her second question, and then I'm going to get to yours. And then the second question is, can you remind me because you build on, in your book, you build on, you know, Claire Jean Kim's racial triangulation. Can you remind me of the framework that you call?
Imperialist
racial formation, right. So I work with Claire, at UCI, and she has really influenced me in terms of, like, her rejecting her own work, her own past work. So Claire Kim devised this thing called racial triangulation, where it's basically an X and Y axis that says, you know, well, if Asian Americans are like higher in terms of Black Americans in terms of their, like, cultural value, or, you know, then class, yeah, and then so Black Americans are kind of like higher on the other axis in terms of, like, insiderness, or, and she's been challenging me to kind of think about, well, again, there is something to be said that, like, you're not a foreigner, right, or you're not going to be told go back home, you know, but what is, It's a kind of empty insiderness, right? Where you have this, like, citizenship, and you don't, I guess, operate under, I'm gonna, you know, go back to your country. But I mean, yeah, as we've seen, like, Black people can't have barbecues without getting the police call them or take a nap or whatever. So what is that? To what extent is that insiderness, that, you know, even valuable? Mm-hmm. I don't know, is, yeah. Okay, I think we need to have a long conversation about it. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, sorry, yeah. So, you mentioned earlier, I was surprised about the link of immigration from South Korea,
mm-hmm.
including the second group.
Yeah.
That was really surprising, because it is true, like, Mexico, for instance, the migration is they're coming, but they're going back to Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And but why is that? Because South Korea is one of the four tigers in the world. You know, of the economy, it's excellent, like, world primary. How come that's happening? that there's a high increase in early
voting rates. Yeah. So, I mean, most people really do kind of root it back to the 1997-1998 Asian financial crisis, which for working class people was particularly devastating. Like, was it some? I don't know if someone can help me with the statistic. There was something like 50% unemployment at some point. Yeah. So that was kind of like the first wave. A lot of the folks that I talk to now are coming because of continued financial difficulties. Because, yeah, you have really rich people in South Korea, but you also have really poor people, right? But also because of the intensity of the education structure. So a lot of parents that I talk to about why they decided to bring their family over here is because they did not want their kids subject to the rigidity of the educational system and the pressure in South Korea. I have another paper that I wrote about how that kind of creates for undocumented youth here. It kind of creates them like feeling like they have a kind of privilege in relationship to like, say, like Central American folks who are fleeing gang violence or like extreme poverty. They're like, you know, well, I guess my story isn't as bad because my parents brought me here because they were scared that about me having to face these really scary, you know, prospects of like, if you don't get into Yonsei or Seolde or whatever, you're going to be a failure in life, right? So a lot of people are coming over for that reason now too, in addition to the economic stuff. Yeah. No, I think, yeah.
You know, outside of the community. For example, I was talking to an African-American gentleman, and one of the things he said is, all these immigrants come here and they get benefits. And it is, they feel like the resources which would have been used, should be used for the African-American community, right, is going towards the immigrants. So that's one point of view. And another point of view, I was talking to another gentleman, and we were talking about, you know, Asians being successful. Mm-hmm. And I said, yeah, because, you know, like say among Koreans, you know, if you have want to start a business, you go within the community, and you have a system where you borrow mm-hmm. from within the community. You don't have to go to the banks. And also, say among the Indian community, you know, right, it's a family structure, and everybody helps each other within the family. So there are social structures mm-hmm. which make it successful. And he said, but we don't have that. So there's two things going on. One is the immigrants having their own. Even if they don't have money, they have the family community right. structure which supports each other, you know, which has nothing to do with welfare or anything like that. Mm-hmm. And on the other hand, the perception that, you know, the immigrants are getting resources. So that seems to be yeah. causing a lot of friction.
Oh, totally.
From whatever I have heard and seen.
Yeah. So, yeah. So I think this is another one of these really dangerous narratives that, not as Nadia said, like we all need to be internalizing all of this in order for white supremacy to work, right? So, again, it's really convenient to say to black people, you know, the reason that, you know, you're down and out on your luck, it's because all the immigrants coming in. It's not, you know, corporations, it's not the entire capitalist structure that thrives on undocumented labor that couldn't exist in this country without undocumented labor and immigrant labor, right? So, yeah, I get really sad when I hear that, too, because, I mean, I could go into statistics about how immigrants actually, you know, undocumented immigrants actually contribute much more in taxes than they take from the system. You can't get benefits if you're undocumented. That's, like, how would you get benefits if you're undocumented, you know? So that's something that I hear that a lot, and it makes me really sad. And then to the second question, I think that, so, you know, like, after the LA uprising, where there are the Flatbush boycotts here in New York, I think in 1990, where Haitian communities boycotted Korean store owners in Flatbush, what often comes out of that are buy black campaigns, right? Where the black community will mobilize, and say, we're going to buy from these stores. And so, but then there's also pushback on that. because sometimes I've heard is because, and the pushback comes from like, well, is black liberation really tied to the extent to which black people are better able to participate in capitalist structures, which is essentially what that does, you know what I mean? Or is that, it, like, is that the most important form of resistance, right? Because even if you have all these black stores and everything, if we have these underlying, you know, anti-black structures, are those stores going to be successful? And what does it do? You know what I mean? So it's really complicated, and it's, but there are efforts within black communities to do, you know, by black campaigns. But again, having the capital, you know, the lending practices in this company to be able to get the capital to start a business in the first place. So these things are super rooted, in much longer stories. Yes?
I was just wondering, what was NACASEC's rationale from going from a platform of clean green map to citizenship for all? Like,
yeah.
Let's go for something, you know, this is hard, so why don't we go for something harder?
Yeah. I think because of some of the things I was talking about, it's like, you know, even if we're saying Clean Dream Act, the Dream Act itself is still only a path to legalization for this very circumscribed set of people. And, you know, what do people talk about? That's why people avoid, like, the term dreamers now, right? It's because what does it do? It's saying, oh, these are folks, young folks, who deserve to be here because they were brought here through no fault of their own, right? So what does that do? It criminalizes your parents who brought you here. Would I be here without my parents? It criminalizes everyone who isn't, you know, a high school student or a college student or who hasn't had the opportunities to be able to do these things. So it became this sense of like, and again, it was like some of these really discouraging encounters with politicians where it was like, they don't give a shit. I think for a lot of young people, like I really like to refrain from saying that like the Trump administration is as big of a challenge, like everything was messed up beforehand too, right? But it's one thing it's done, it's mobilized a lot of people. And so for a lot of folks going to DC in 2017, it was the first time that they were having an encounter of this sort with a politician. And for them, it really like broke the illusion that, that these politicians are there for them, you know? So again, it was this, this is counterproductive to what we want to do if we keep saying even Clean Dream Act, right? So we're going to say citizenship for all, which means we're not going to distinguish between undocumented people, and we're also going to include intercountry adoptees who have never gotten citizenship and asylees and refugees, and we're going to also talk about how citizenship itself, like, as they said, like, black and native communities may have access to citizenship, but what is it doing for them, right? Are they full citizens of the country? So it became a broad platform, but then again, not one that they actually think is going to be delivered on politically.
Sure. Or the works that you like, yeah, upon, like, you're like, yes, thank you. And what do you plan on doing afterwards with this?
Sure. The methods are typical ethnographic methods. So interview, like long-term semi-structured interviews, which means I come in with a general list of questions but kind of bring the conversation to wherever it goes. Participant observation, which basically means being there, like being at all of these events that I've talked about, and putting my body into those things too. Those are the main things in terms of methods. What was that? Sorry, what was the other question?
Any main words?
Oh, right. So Nadia Kim's Imperial Citizens. I mentioned Kathy Schlenbeil's. She had an edited volume out last year, called?
Flashpoints.
Flashpoints for Asian American Studies. It talks a lot about the Peter Liang and Akai Gurley stuff. There's some really awesome essays in there. Claire Jean Kim, who is really in kind of like the late 1990s, had this influential theory called racial triangulation, which she herself describes as super problematic. That's what I just described about like the black insiderness and whatever. So she's actually taken a turn towards looking at Asian American studies through the lens of a literature called Afro-pessimism, which is a line of that kind of diverts from the black radical tradition. It would be a lot to explain right now, but you can look that up. Audra Simpson and Monisha Dasgupta, who are kind of looking at social movements and refusing what you would think most social movements are after. And then Susan Coutine, who's one of my mentors, who I quoted quite extensively, who has been doing work on undocumented immigrant rights activism for a long time. Yeah.
How do you plan on centering it or making it more broad?
Yeah. So, right now I'm in the middle of the field work. So, of course, there's the typical, academic stuff, publishing papers and writing my dissertation so I can get my PhD. But I really try to make this kind of writing available to the organizations that I work with and have conversations with them about, not that I know, like, I don't know better than they do. It's not like I'm like, oh, let me give you this advice, right? But writing in such a way that can be helpful in terms of fostering dialogue and reflection. Because part of the reason I started a PhD in the first place was that I was working in an immigrant rights organization and never had time for reflection on what I was actually doing and made mistakes at every single turn. And you know what I mean? And not that I'm saying that my writing is going to help people not make mistakes, but I have the privilege of being able to like look at these things and just think about them all the time instead of putting out the fires that people who work in nonprofits and have their boots on the ground have to do every day. So for example, I sent Nakasek, this paper before I put it together so we could have a conversation about it. And then I want to be better about writing more, like HuffPost kind of stuff. I kind of got out of the weeds of the worst part of your PhD just recently. So I want to be better about writing more like accessible public articles that make these ideas kind of more broadly spread. If there are no more questions, then thank you so much for coming.